Okay, yesterday I talked about domain walls. The idea being twofold, really. One was to illustrate the process, well, maybe even threefold, to illustrate the process of solving Einstein equations with some matter source. So you're looking at a specific team you knew, which might be a little bit different to some of the examples that you've seen so far, because the examples you commonly meet first are things like perfect fluids, whether that be in the context of cosmology or, say, looking at a candidate solution for a star. So that might have been a little bit different or new. There was also this notion of non-perturbative field theory solutions. So this idea that you could have a stable solution that was distinct from the vacuum and indeed disconnected from the vacuum because it took an infinite energy to go from that solution to the vacuum. The other reason that I introduced the domain wall was to move towards this idea of looking at gravity of submanifolds. So the wall itself has one direction normal to it. So it is in our case, it's a three-dimensional submanifold of our four-dimensional space-time. And we saw that, in fact, as far as the gravity was concerned, at least for the pure wall space-time, most of it, the space was vacuum, except in this very narrow region as we went through the core of the wall. And so at the time, I said it almost looked like a delta function. And so we're going to explore that notion of actually seeing if we can make something infinitesimally thin. Now, I got a bit rushed towards the end of the lecture yesterday, so hopefully when I've done introduced the concept and the mathematics of submanifolds, I'll go back to what I was saying at the end of yesterday's lecture, because I think it got a little bit scrambled. I was enjoying your questions, and I probably spent a bit too much time on them. So I shall try not to do that again. Right. So submanifolds, the notion. The reason why we want to think about submanifolds is, as I said, this notion of a domain wall. We could then ask the question about whether we could go to D minus 2, D minus 3, and so on, submanifolds. And then the other reason I want to discuss this, at least that I'll be applying this formalism to, is the variation of the Einstein-Hilbert action. And thinking about the boundary terms. So when I talked about the Einstein-Hilbert action and took the variation of R, I noted that the boundary was not quite legitimate. And so we can go back and look at the boundary and see if by thinking about perhaps adding an action for the boundary, we can make things work. And then finally, although I won't really be discussing it, this formalism applies to a 3 plus 1 formulation of GR. And I guess you'll be seeing it if you do the quantum gravity course. And I gather that Latham also, did you say, Anna, that Latham also uses it in his cosmology course? No? Okay. Anyway, so it's an introduction to a particular formalism. It's actually got quite a wide range of applications. Right. So it's known as Gauss-Kodazzi, I guess because these guys were the mathematicians who originally started to try and define what it meant and how you worked with submanifolds. So we're going to imagine that sigma is some surface. At the moment, I'm not going to say of how many dimensions. I'm not going to be specific, so I'm going to say it can have an arbitrary dimension, p plus 1. So I'm going to imagine that it has a time-like direction in it, because in the end, at least the applications that I'll be discussing, sigma often has an interpretation as some sort of physical object, you know, some sort of extended physical object as opposed to a point-like object. So I wanted to have a time-like direction. And so you can think of this plus one as being time, and this as being the number of spatial dimensions of this submanifold. So sigma itself is going to be a differentiable manifold in its own right of dimension p plus one. But in addition to that, it also has an interpretation as being some subset of our underlying manifold M. So we have two pictures of sigma. One is a manifold in its own right, and the other is where it's living inside M, and so you can imagine it inherits some of the local structure of M that's projected down onto sigma. And then we define a codimension of sigma essentially to be the complement of the dimension of sigma. So it's the number of independent directions in the manifold which do not lie in sigma. So in other words, we take the dimension of the manifold D and subtract P plus 1. So if we imagine that we take internal coordinate charts on sigma, so we have a coordinate or set of functions sigma A, then this is saying that we have, if a vector is giving you a normal to sigma, capital sigma, then it means that it projects, it has a sort of zero projection lying on sigma itself. So of course we know intuitively what that means. In this picture here, I simply stick some normal vector which points out of sigma. So we've got a picture of what that means in terms of our manifold. So another way of writing this in a sort of abstract index type of notation is that we would imagine that we can define our surface sigma by its coordinate functions. If we go to local charts, so this defines sigma. And then dx mu by d sigma a are like tangent, things tangent to the submanifold. And so if we take the contraction of that with a normal one form, then we get zero. So that's just a different way of putting it. So now we want to describe how sigma inherits structure from the underlying manifold M. So again, we have a very good intuitive notion of this because we can, in our minds, we can picture some two-dimensional surface living in three-dimensional real space, and we can sort of see how that inherits some, you know, some sort of distance function from our Cartesian standard Euclidean three-dimensional space. And so we just simply have to formalize that and write down what we actually mean. So H, which is the first fundamental form of sigma, is like taking the metric on the manifold M and projecting out all normal directions. So H is going to end up being a projection operator acting within the tangent space of M, taking you from a sort of general vector and projecting it down to its component parallel to sigma. So there's just a factor there, because obviously, because we have a Lorentzian manifold and not a Euclidean manifold, our space-like directions tend to come with a minus sign in G, and so we have to add one, if you like, to get rid of them. And a time-like direction, of course, comes with a plus one, which is why we've got to subtract the ends in order to get the right projection. So our normals will all be space-like, so that would be just plus NA NB. But if you were doing, for example, the Hamiltonian formulation of GR, then your normal would be time-like, because then you foliate space with space-like hypersurfaces. And so in that case, with a signature, you'd be subtracting N, A, and B. So there'll be two different types of notation that you're going to see when you're considering submanifolds. On the one hand, you can stick with objects which live in the tangent bundle or in this, or cotangent bundle or whatever, of the manifold M, but are somehow restricted to some subspace of that. Or you could think about the submanifold as a differential manifold in its own right, in which case you'd want to be thinking about things intrinsic to the submanifold. In which case you need to project down onto the tangent bundle of sigma. And so although gamma and H are physically the same thing and contain the same information, mathematically they're distinct because this thing lives in, it's got sort of manifold indices, A and B run from naught to D minus one, but they run over D possible choices, whereas here, this just runs over P plus one choices, okay? So, I think I've got a better picture here. Just sketch that. So in terms of the coordinate patches, we're imagining we've got these sigma A's over here, we've got the X's over here, and then we've got this map that takes our sigmas to some image in our manifold. And so this dx mu by d sigma A So we've seen this in terms of maps before, is these objects are simply taking us, we've got our map from sigma to M, and then this gives us a map from the cotangent space of M back into the cotangent space of sigma. So far, I haven't really done anything too dramatic. All I've done is said I've got this subset of M, which is also a differentiable manifold in its own right. I can define it by a restriction of my coordinates to some subspace, and it inherits a metric from the underlying manifold. Now I want to go beyond that and start trying to think about more information about this embedding. And so the next thing you look at is what's called the second fundamental form or extrinsic curvature. So to get the extrinsic curvature, what we do is we take the covariant derivative of the normals and then project it down onto parallel to the submanifold using the first fundamental form. So what this is doing, if I sort of imagine some curved submanifold, in this case just a line, and draw the normals. So here's my surface. And then I want to look at how the normal changes. So what this is saying is, take the derivative of the normal, but you want the parallel components to sigma. So if I imagine moving just a little bit away from the surface along the normal, you can see that here, the way in which the normal changes, if my surface curves, so if we imagine here we're just dealing with a line on a flat plane, if the line curves, you can see that the normal vector will actually shift in direction as you move along the submanifold or along the line. And so you can see that this is going to give you some non-zero extrinsic curvature. So intuitively, we recognize extrinsic curvature because we see it as being when a surface is not flat. So we can imagine that if we take a piece of paper, but instead of having a flat piece of paper, we curve it round, then we think that piece of paper is curved. So this is actually our first intuitive understanding of curvature. It's not real curvature, it's actually extrinsic curvature. So the first time someone tells you, for example, which we'll be seeing in a minute, that this cylinder here is flat, typically you sort of look at them and you think, come on, you know, right? That's usually the first reaction. And then as you learn more about curvature, you understand the cylinder really is flat. But what we're doing when we react in that way, the first time to saying the cylinder is curved, is our own intuitive notion is of the embedding, that this is curved, it's a circle, it's curved in our manifold, which in this case is just R cubed. So extrinsic curvature is actually quite an intuitive notion of curvature, and it's sort of the one that we first meet. So let's actually look at that example of the cylinder. So we're looking at a submanifold of R cubed defined by a cylinder of radius A. So this is our submanifold. So a unit normal would be just cos theta, sine theta, zero. So that's just an outward pointing normal. So in terms of HAB, if I ask what's the first fundamental form, now, if I do it in Cartesians, I get something that looks a little bit of a mess. However, if I go to plane polars, I get something that looks clearly like it's a projection operator. So you can see this lives in the tangent bundle of M, which is R cubed, because it's got three entries. But you can also equally well see that it's projecting parallel to the cylinder sigma, because it's got a zero, a row and column of zeros. So a natural set of intrinsic coordinates for my surface would be theta and z. Then it's fairly easy to see that the intrinsic metric is just diagonal, and it's just got a factor of a squared in front of the theta theta piece. So what's the extrinsic curvature? Well, if I do it in polar coordinates, simply because it's easier, then my normal is obviously d by dr. And so to get my extrinsic curvature, I just have to look at the components of the connection with an R on the upper, in the upper slot. So when I do that, the only thing I pick up is a theta theta piece. And that's just, so gamma r theta theta is simply minus r, which r is a on the cylinder. And so hence I get a bang in the middle there. So my extrinsic curvature is indeed non-zero. Mm-hmm. So, because in this case, when you go to polar coordinates, your Cartesians, right, are, you know, dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared, whereas you've got dr squared plus r squared d theta squared plus dz squared. So there's an explicit r in there. So, good question. Where is the a? I'm just trying to think. Yeah, no, I must have, good question. You know, I've never squared 111. I suppose if I had to write this, this I've written in terms of the polar coordinates. So I'm sort of thinking, how would I write that in terms of my underlying coordinates? And so I guess if I tried to write it in terms of underlying coordinates, I'd have to do things like, in this case, this would be y squared on a squared, and this would be x squared on a squared, and then my x squared, you know, which would be equal to y squared. So I suppose if I if I try and write things in terms of the actual coordinates rather than cheating, my, I don't know, I'm just thinking. So sine squared theta, I just said, was y squared on a squared. Cos squared theta is x squared on a squared, which is 1 minus y squared on a squared. So if I start writing it like that, in terms of the actual coordinates, then my a comes back in, I guess. Yeah, because what I'm trying to do when I project down is I would have to take this particular metric, dx squared plus dy squared, and then freeze it on this surface where I'm constrained with, you know, that x squared dx has to be related to dy. So this is as it lives in a subset of my, you know, my actual tangent space of R cubed, but then if I have to apply it to real distances, actually in sigma, then, you know, although the real distances are still dx and dy don't take me so far around on my cylinder if A is bigger. No. So I can write also my extrinsic curvature in another way. So if my k is simply the projection of the covariant derivative of n onto the submanifold. Obviously, I can project it down into the tangent space of the submanifold. But then if I look here, I know that the contraction of n with this projection operator vanishes. So I can also say that this is equal to I can also express it as a derivative of these sort of tangent vectors here. And so sometimes you will see, oops, I've gone, should be that. Sometimes you'll see this other expression for the extrinsic curvature, usually in the context of the trace of the extrinsic curvature, which would then be equal to the wave operator lying within the submanifold of the x coordinates. So in terms of formulation, or at least when I guess you do in introductory string theory, your string is a two-dimensional manifold, and so it has coordinates sigma and tau, so those are your a equals 1 and 2 or 0 and 1. And so you see a lot of these expressions will crop up again. And the x mu's, which are the coordinates of the world sheet in some underlying manifold, these now become individual fields. So although from our perspective, they're a classical manifold, when you do string theory, you'll actually be thinking of these now as being fields, and your string world sheet as somehow being the fundamental underlying space. And so you get equations of motion that look a bit like box x equals zero. So I've kept this little I index to emphasize that in principle there are many normals, but what can happen if you have codimension greater than one So if you have codimension greater than one, for example, a line in R cubed, then you could imagine your normals could actually vary the way you choose the normals at different places on your submanifold can be non-trivial. So you have to figure out how to link the normal spaces as you move through the submanifold. And you do this by the so-called normal fundamental forms. And that's taking the covariant derivative of a normal. And instead of projecting it parallel to the manifold, you project it perpendicular. So if you've got codimension bigger than one, then your tangent space splits. I mean, it always splits into parallel and perpendicular, but if the perpendicular is just a single direction, it kind of doesn't have any any particular non-trivial structure. But the moment you have more than one normal direction, then your normal space now can have a non-trivial structure. So that's really what these do, although I'm not going to use them, I'm just simply pointing them out for completeness. So I'm going to assume that my normals extend geodesically off the submanifold into the manifold, because when I'm deriving expressions, I'm going to have to take derivatives of the normal fields. And as far as the submanifold's concerned, I just need to know what the normal is on the submanifold. And so I extend it off the submanifold geodesically. And also that the normal covariant derivative of my normals vanish, at least locally. So having derived these, we've derived an intrinsic or induced metric and an extrinsic curvature. At the moment, we've just been taking or looking at things which are related to the connection on our manifold. So the normal fundamental forms are like a normal part of a derivative of the ends. The second fundamental forms are like a parallel derivative of the n. So at the moment, it looks like we're thinking about extracting information from the connection, but not so much the curvature. So we would like to, the Gauss equation relates relates the curvatures of the underlying manifold to the intrinsic curvature of the submanifold with some extra pieces. So the Gauss equation tells us that our so the first thing it tells us is that if we want the intrinsic Riemann curvature of our surface, we project down the manifold's Riemann curvature. And then we have to add a correction piece. And so you can see, if we think about our extrinsic curvatures as carrying some sort of information about the connection, but information that actually has some meaning to us intuitively, because it's telling us how sigma curves in M, then when we try and project down the Riemann curvature of our manifold, we see that we almost get the Riemann curvature of the submanifold, but there are extra pieces. We've got to subtract off the curvature that we get coming just from the embedding, this extrinsic piece. So we'll go through, we'll demonstrate this for just codimension one. And so we'll derive this expression by using the Riemann identity. So I'm imagining I've got a vector which is parallel to sigma, so it lies in that subspace of the tangent space which is parallel to sigma, so that's what I put in brackets. And I'm using the Riemann identity acting on V. Now, one of the things you're going to explore in today's tutorial is how you project down the covariant derivative from the manifold onto the submanifold. But the basic rule of the game is that you simply take the expression in M, so you take the covariant derivative of V in the tangent bundle of M, and then you just project down every free index with the first fundamental form. So that's the rule of the game. Can't read my own writing on that. So, right. Right, so let's have a look at what this tells us. So, I said that the rule of the game for the submanifold connection is that I take the manifold covariant derivative, so this is the manifold covariant derivative, and I project down on every free index. So that's what I've done. I've done that for the first derivative, C. So that says take the manifold derivative. That's projecting the C index, the D index, and the A index, okay? And then I write again. In order to look at this covariant derivative, so I'm getting quite a lengthy expression there for the moment, but I'm just writing everything down just to sort of make a start. So now, let me go over here. This, so that's just saying because this is, because that's the Riemann identity, it's the commutator of the derivatives, I apologize. Forgot to put those square brackets there. So in other words, I don't want to have to write down each thing with just C and D swapped. So I'm just keeping that going to just remind myself at the end, I have to anti-symmetrize on C and D. So here, I'm going to take this covariant derivative through an axon each of these objects in turn. So the first one is where it hits the derivative of V. So here I pick up these projection operators. But then when this H hits this H, I simply get the contraction HDQ. So that's my first term. I've then got to take derivatives of these first fundamental forms. But if I look at my expression for the first fundamental form, it's just equal to the metric. So obviously the covariant derivative of the metric vanishes. And then it's this minus to the I with factors of the normal. So here, for this first, let me just put this here, this is delta PQ minus NP NQ. So if I take obviously, the covariant derivative of NP NQ is the covariant derivative of NP times NQ plus the covariant derivative of NQ times NP. But I've got an H sitting out here with a P index. So NP HPD every time I contract a normal, with a first fundamental form, I get zero. So in terms of this derivative, the only thing I'm interested in is picking up that derivative of n. And then the last term is where I take the derivative of this. This is the worst step, okay? So after this step, they get easier. So here I've taken the derivative grad f of her, and spotting this first fundamental form with an e index out here, I know that the only piece of this which could possibly contribute is the derivative grad f of ne. So that's why I've kept this piece here. And so in that, and I've not taken the derivative of nr, because otherwise this would give me zero. So now let me just have a little look and see what I've actually got. Here I've got something where I'm anti-symmetrizing on C and D. And if I anti-symmetrize on C and D, I'm going to anti-symmetrize on F and Q, which are the derivatives sitting in front of V here. So that I can use my higher dimensional manifolds Riemann identity there. So I know how to deal with the first line. If I look at the second line, I know that the derivative of N is going to give me an extrinsic curvature, but here I've got a normal derivative of V, which is going to vanish. Because V is parallel to my manifold. And then finally, if I look at the bottom line, I've got the covariant derivative of N with an index F and an index E, both of which have H's sitting outside. So that tells me that's going to give me an extrinsic curvature. So I know how to express that. Meanwhile, if I look at the N and V terms, I notice that NR grad Q VR is actually minus VR grad Q NR, because V and N are also orthogonal. So I know how to rearrange each of these lines. So my first line, I use the Riemann identity, so I replace my higher dimensional Riemann tensor in there. Second line gives me zero, and then the third line so from the first derivative of n, KFE, I get a KAC when it hits these two H's. And then for the second one, I've got VR KDR. So that's what I end up with. And then I've got to subtract the reverse if I swap my C and D. So now all I do is relabel everything. So on the left-hand side, I've got R, A, B, C, D. Times VB. And then I look on my right-hand side, I can see I've got a whole list of indices, which I think might have gone astray. So and so you can see that, in fact, what I've written down there, if I pull away the V, is exactly that first line. So that sort of demonstrates the relation. So what this has done now is it said, well, my Riemann curvature, if I try computing a Riemann curvature of the submanifold, I get that by the Riemann curvature inherited from the manifold together with some extrinsic curvature pieces. So this now shows how you can sort of, if you think you've got a non-flat manifold, such as the cylinder, my cylinder has non-trivial extrinsic curvature, but if you try and compute its actual curvature, the Riemann curvature, R cubed has no curvature, so the first term vanishes. And then the second term, if you actually look and see whether this can give you any contribution, because there's only one non-zero component of K, the anti-symmetry here kills you. So you can see that this gives you precisely zero Riemann curvature for the cylinder. Hence that slightly odd, or initially odd result that a cylinder is actually flat.
The Riemann tensor P plus one, the indices A, B, C, D run from one through the dimension of the manifold still?
Yeah, so it's that lies in the tangent bundle of the manifold, but it's in a sort of subset of that tangent bundle. But the indices run over the manifold indices. What you could do is you could say that was precisely equivalent. So this R, A, B, C, D would be equivalent to an R, A, capital A, B, C, D, where this is now lying in the submanifold, where you would use those projection operators, certainly on B, C, and D, to project you down. So this would then be running out of. There. So you would simply take that lower dimensional, the sigma Riemann, and then you would project it into the tangent bundle of sigma as a manifold in its own right. So I'm going to stop here because it's already, the hour's already up. So this afternoon, you'll be looking in a bit more detail at this particular formalism and just trying to look more closely at the covariant derivative and just build up a little bit of intuition. So tomorrow, I'll apply this. We'll take another look at that domain wall and we'll derive the Israel equations and then go back to the solution, the full non-perturbative field theory solution, and sort of see how the two actually work and give the same answer. And then I'll also look at the boundary terms for the Einstein-Hilbert action. And both of those examples will simply be codimension one. So